Our guest is Yung Chang, internationally acclaimed author. Her book, Wild Swans, is a celebrated account of the lives of her grandmother, her mother, and herself, living through the turbulent modern history of China. It has sold over 13 million copies around the world and been translated into 37 languages. The Sunday Telegraph said it showed a luminous intelligence directed at the heart of darkness. She has written three other books, including, with her husband John Halliday, Mao, The Unknown Story, a devastating account of Mao Zedong's life. Yung Chang was born in 1952 in Yibin in the Sichuan province of China, the daughter of two Communist Party officials. In 1966, at the age of 14, Yung Chang joined the Red Guards, the students whom Mao had asked to cleanse the party of revisionists in the so-called Cultural Revolution. But she became disenchanted with the violence and left. Her father also opposed the violence, which resulted in him becoming a victim of the Cultural Revolution himself. Yung Chang saw her father being arrested. He was imprisoned and became physically and mentally ill. Her mother was pressured to denounce her husband, and when she refused, she was repeatedly humiliated and tortured. Yung herself was sent to the country to live as a peasant. She also had to work as a doctor and an electrician, although she had no qualifications for either role. Eventually, she was able to go to university, and after Mao's death in 1976, finally she got a scholarship which enabled her to come to England in 1978, where she continues to live today. Welcome, Yung Chang.
Thank you.
Your parents both became committed members of the Communist Party. Your father was so thoroughly dedicated that sometimes he didn't give your mother things because it would be against his principles to give her special treatment, which even caused her to be offended. But they were both committed members of the Communist Party. And later, as a very young person, you followed suit and joined the Red Guards. Can you explain why your parents, and later yourself, became members of the Communist Party? What did they believe in?
Right. My father was born in 1921. When he was a teenager, and he saw a lot of poverty and injustice in the city he was living in. And so he, from a very young age, he felt the society had to change. And then the communists, of course, promised to change all this and to bring a better life to people and to end starvation, so people would have food to eat, as my father told me when I was a child. So he joined the communists when he was a teenager. And that's how he joined. My mother was living in Manchuria in North China. She joined the Communist Underground when she was 15. And because the communists for her promised women's liberation and promised to end concubinage, for example. I mean, my grandmother had been a concubine of a warlord general when he was 15. She'd been given by her father to this warlord general. And she had a very sad life. And so my mother grew up in that world, and she was dying to change that world. And she found this particular aspect very appealing. So she joined the communists when she was a student at the age of 15. Now, with the Communist Party, the thing is, once you joined, you couldn't leave. To leave would be like to desertion, and you would be punished harshly all your life. In fact, soon after, my mother met the real communists who took her city in 1948. And when she met my father, who'd been a communist guerrilla fighter outside her city, and they met and got married. As soon as she met the real communists, she became disillusioned as early as that. And one thing, for example, about her mother being this former concubine, I mean, there were a lot of family tragedies. Perhaps we won't go into all that. But what devastated her was her bosses of the Communist Women's Association, who were supposed to be liberating concubines, actually despised the concubines and despised my mother. And they wouldn't even sit together with my grandmother at my mother's wedding to my father. So my mother was completely devastated. And in the other thing, for example, I mean, she was also attracted by communism, by their promise of bringing equality to the society. But she realized that there was no equality. I mean, she and my father, for example, they had different ranks. They couldn't eat the same food. And when they eventually had to leave from Manchuria to Sichuan, over 1,000 miles away, my father was a senior communist official, so he was entitled to a jeep or a car or a horse, whichever was available. And my mother was new to the revolution. She had to walk, and so she suffered a miscarriage on the way. And she was devastated, and at the age of 18, very soon after she was with the main communist army, she wanted to leave. She wanted to go back to Manchuria and to study for medicine. But my father, in letter after letter, even telegrams, urged her not to leave. And the reason, I mean, of course, he couldn't spell out, was once you left, once the communists took power, you would be in dead trouble. And which was what happened later. And so my mother could feel the urgency in my father's letters. And that's how she didn't leave. She stayed with the communists, and both of them then became part of the communist administration.
And in 1963, when you were about 11, Mao promoted a cult of emulating Lei Feng, a soldier who had died young and who, we were told, was somebody who loved Mao and who did good deeds. And so there was a lot of enthusiasm for people to go and do good deeds and also to love and follow Mao. And he allegedly, because a lot of the stuff about him is not reliable, allegedly wrote a poem called The Four Seasons. And these are the lines from it which you and your fellow students at school had to learn by heart. Like spring, I treat my comrades warmly. Like summer, I am full of ardor for my revolutionary work. I eliminate my individualism as an autumn gale sweeps away fallen leaves. And to the class enemy, I am cruel and ruthless like harsh winter. Could you tell us about how this doctrine of hatred of the class enemy and how you saw people putting it into effect?
It started with doing good deeds. As young people, you know, we were
1964.
Yes. I was in my early teens. I was born in 1952, so that would make me 11 or 12. And at that age, and the young people wanted to be helpful, so we were at train stations or at the crossroads to try to help elderly people with their luggage, to help them go across the road. So that was quite, in a way, fun. Mm-hmm. But still, there was I began to feel very uneasy, because I at the time, what struck me very much were these cart pullers in the city, and people who pulled enormous weight on the cart, but physically. And so I had most sympathy for these people. And so I, since this campaign started, I sat on the lower part of the road, because the slope was the most difficult thing for them to overcome. Mm. So I would push from the back.
Yeah.
I regard that was my good deed of learning from Lei Feng. Mm. But then one day, a teacher told me that I must stop doing that, because the cart pullers were class enemies. They were usually condemned to hard labor, and that was their punishment. So I remember the moments of shock, of trying to understand what this meant. But later on in the campaign, it became more and more clear that these acts of love or good deeds were actually not so important. The most important thing about learning from Lei Feng is to do what Mao said, to be harsh to class enemies, and to always follow Mao. And so if Mao asked us to destroy something, we would go and destroy it. If Mao says to, in those days, Linguo, to smash somebody's dog's head as a harsh way of denouncing a class enemy, we were supposed to do that.
And did you see people at school? Because there were division at that time into reds and blacks and greys, and people who had presumably been your friends were suddenly classified, and it was enforced as blacks. And what did that mean, and what did they have to do?
So in 1966, Mao started his Cultural Revolution, which was his great purge. In order to achieve his goal, he wanted to create a gigantic terror in the country. And for this, he needed victims. So teachers became victims, and the children themselves, the students, some of them also became victims. At the time, in all schools, the children were divided into the blacks, the grays, and the reds. The blacks were the children who came from undesirable families. I mean, in China, under Mao, people were classified into different categories. So when I first came to Britain, I thought Britain was wonderfully classless.
Because you had, in that case, you had forms in China. Whenever you filled in a form, as you described in Wild Swans, you had to describe what your background was.
Yes, yes. I mean, after name, date of birth, sex, family, background.
Yes. And that determined your whole life, whether you would have a good life or a good career, or whether you would be an outcast.
Yes, exactly. So those people who came from the undesirable background were classified as blacks, and those who came from good background were the reds.
And they were the workers or Communist Party members?
Yes, workers, poor peasants. Mm. I mean, the peasants were divided into different categories. The rich peasants, the landowners, they were the bad ones. Mm. The middle peasants, the lower middle peasants. The lower peasants were the greys, or the children of the lower peasants were grace, and the poor peasants and poor and lower middle peasants were the right. good ones, yes, the yeah. desirable ones.
So it was literally class division and more or less class warfare.
Class, yes, except the children themselves were not landowners, they were the children of. Mm. And so as one of Mao's followers said, before we fought their fathers, I mean now our children must fight their children.
And so even if you were a child, you know, you could be classified as black. And what would be the consequence at school?
Well, in the schools, the reds usually tormented or even beaten up the blacks. For example, in my class, I remember there was a friend of mine. We were very good friends, and suddenly she became a black. Because her father was classified, I think, as a capitalist, which was bad, black. And so her hair was shaven halfway, which is called the yin yang head, half with hair, half without hair. And that was a sign of humiliation, was humiliation. She was a young girl. In some cases, the reds would string the blacks together with a rope and drove them like driving animals and make them work. The work meaning to clean up the school, to pull grass out of the school lawn, because Mao had turned against the horticulture and condemned growing flowers and grass as bourgeois. And so we all had to go out and destroy the flower beds and the lawn of our school. In my school, I didn't catch the full picture, but I saw a girl throwing herself out of a third floor window. Because she had been classified as a gray. Her father actually was a communist official. It was, just wasn't a high official, was a, you know, like more like a clerk. And before she had been a student cadre, student official. She'd been very correct. And so there were some boys who hated her. Now suddenly these boys found themselves to be reds because their fathers were higher officials than this girl's father. And so they started to, they classified her as gray and started to torment her. And she couldn't take it. She tried to commit suicide. She didn't die, but she was paralyzed. I had such nightmares over that glimpse of a body falling through the trees of our school campus.
Yes. You became a Red Guard yourself. You were very young. You were only 14, and you were taken on what was called a house raid. Can you say what is a house raid and what happened on the house raid you were taken on?
The Red Guards or the school children were encouraged to raid the houses of the undesirables, of the capitalists or the landlords or something that the regime classified as black. The regime, first of all, this was a move to terrorize the whole society because everybody could see so-and-so's house was raided. There would be violence, the owners would be beaten up, And so everybody was terrorized that house raids was the single most important thing that terrorized the whole of China. Well, there were more, many other things, but this was a major thing. The one I was swept onto was the result of some neighbors coming to the Red Guards to denounce a woman, saying that she had hidden a portrait of Chiang Kai-shek in the house. And the Red Guards, teenagers, just went on this, I think a couple of trucks, to this woman's household. And they started to search, and they start to dig the garden, and they stripped half naked of this woman. I think there were some very sadistic boys, was just totally horrible. And she was crying, she was screaming. She said, "I had no portrait of Chiang Kai-shek."
Can you just mention who Chiang Kai-shek was?
Chiang Kai-shek was the ruler before Mao beat him and threw him to Taiwan.
Yeah.
He was the leader of the Nationalist Party. Mao was the communist.
Yeah.
And so
you were there in the room as she was beaten.
I was with them. You know, there were many people, a huge crowd, and I was. She was beaten. I remember by a boy who I liked very much before, because he had this languid manner which suggested great gentleness. But in fact, he was suddenly transformed into this really vicious character. I think he was enjoy his act. He didn't really care about Chiang Kai-shek or not Chiang Kai-shek. It was not ideology. It was just indulging the worst instinct. And then I think most people there were not keen. And because after a while, everybody then said, let's go. There is no Chiang Kai-shek's portrait.
And how were you feeling at that point? Did you dislike it, or what did you feel about it?
Well, as I just said, I was horrified.
You were horrified,
and I hated all that. Which is why I remembered so vividly. I mean, I hated all that. It was just it was really chilling. It chilled my blood. And of course, I mean, I think I may have said something like, there is no Chiang Kai-shek's portrait or something. I now forgot. That was 1966, so a long time ago. And so I then quickly left. And then at the door, I saw these two women who had come to denounce this neighbor whose house was being raided. And I suddenly realized there was no Chiang Kai-shek's portrait. It was a neighborhood vendetta. And these two women were just using the Red Guards to take some revenge against this other neighbor. And the Red Guards were used to carry out their vendetta for them, because they also looked a bit terrified, because they probably didn't expect the result to be so horrendous.
Yeah, so there are two things here happening. One is people using the Cultural Revolution to exploiting it in order to get revenge on people they didn't like, which is happened to your own family as well. And then also bringing out latent sadism and brutality in people whom, if they'd had a normal life, it might never have come out. Now, your father, like you, didn't like the violence of the Cultural Revolution, and he made it obvious that he didn't like it. And then on the last day of August 1966, members of his department came to take him away, ostensibly for his protection. But this began a long cycle of oppression of him, your mother, and yourself over many years. And your father was severely changed and damaged by what happened to him. Do you have any idea what did happen to him and what was the effect on him?
My father joined the communists when he was a teenager. I think he at some stage he must have been quite start from the beginning. And my father, after he joined the communists, he walked to Yan'an in 1939-1940, because it took him months to get there. And Yan'an was Mao's headquarters during the war against Japan. He got all the young communists from all over the place where he could control to Yan'an in order to terrify them. And so he launched this terrorization campaign, some call it rectification of Yan'an. Basically, he accused everybody to be a spy, because they all come from nationalist areas. And there were just horrendous scenes, we won't go into that, in the early 1940s. And Mao was preparing for his officials. But first of all, he must terrify them in order for them to be obedient officials. I mean, Mao's weapon was always terrorization. So my father was thoroughly terrorized in this campaign, along with other officials of his generation. And after the communists took power, he had various high posts. I think he became thoroughly disillusioned and decided to speak up during the Great Famine between 1958 and 1961. Around 40 million people died of starvation and overwork. My father couldn't have known the full scale or the real reason for the famine, but he knew enough to know that this happened under his party. And it was just the opposite from his youthful dreams when he joined the party, which is to give people a full stomach. Because he was starving. He told me some stories about childhood starvation. And so when the Cultural Revolution started in 1966, and my father finally spoke up. He wrote to Mao to protest the Cultural Revolution and called on Mao to stop it. And he said openly at these denunciation meetings, these ghastly, violent, horrific denunciation meetings when the victims had to face a hysterical crowd yelling blood-curdling slogans. And my father said, there is no culture in this revolution. It's all violence. It's all violence. And people say, how dare you to oppose the Cultural Revolution? And he said, I do oppose the Cultural Revolution. And then they said, but the Cultural Revolution was led by Chairman Mao. And he said, I do oppose it, even if it's led by Chairman Mao.
That was incredible.
I don't think I know few people in the whole of China who did that. And of course, he was ferociously beaten up and he was arrested. That's why he was arrested for his what he said about Mao. And also one thing he did, one utterly ridiculous ritual in the Cultural Revolution, was for the victims to kowtow, to go down on their knees and kowtow to Mao's portrait. And my father tried to force him on his knees to kowtow to Mao to admit his crime. And my father refused. he always struggled to stand up, lift his head, and they would, you know, beat him up and try to force him down. But as soon as they let go, he would stand up straight, lift his head. He absolutely refused to go down on his knees and kowtow. So as a result, he was ferociously beaten up, his ribs were broken, and so on. So he really suffered tremendously, and then exiled to a camp to do heartbreaking labor, and eventually he died after nearly 10 years of mental and physical ordeal.
For a man, I mean, your account of him strikes me as a strong and determined man. For him to mentally suffer, I can only imagine the amount of torture and psychological and physical suffering they must have put him through when you could see, but when you couldn't see.
Yes, I know my father was suffering a lot of mental torment, as well as physical.
And what
abuse.
Was the nature of the mental torment for him?
I think the mental torment was probably because he really seriously believed
in communism.
Believed in communism, and really he. And not only because he was ill abused, but because he saw every aspect of his ideals
fall apart.
Pulled apart, yes. Devastated. Yes.
And he was
people.
Also under pressure from his your mother, his wife, saying, if you do this, your family will suffer. And so he must have had torment of his principles versus his family, which is an agonizing choice to make.
Yes, all the time. I mean, the thing is, after the communists took China, he was appointed the governor of Yibin, which is this large region with a city. And his family were there, and they, for example, I remember the last kind of long conversation I had with him before he died. I think we better not get into that. And he sort of, the communists made this pledge that they were going to end corruption and nepotism. And my father believed that very much. And so when his family came to him for help when he was the governor, I mean, there was the land reform, and his, for example, this cousin of his, who had actually sponsored him when he went to Yan'an to join the communists. But that cousin was a small landowner, and his land was taken away. And so he lost his living, and he came to my father and asked him to recommend him to be a ticket seller at a local cinema. And my father refused and ask him to go through the official channel. I mean, the cousin was so upset because he thought he was the job was extremely poorly paid, and he didn't think it was a big favor to ask for. And so he was so upset with my father, he never spoke to my father again. Mm-hmm. And for his, he did similar things to the members of his family, and they, most of them, never spoke to him again.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So he sort of believed he sacrificed, you know, my mother's interests and us. then eventually, you know, he just thought the whole thing was a sham. He'd believed in a God that had failed him. Mm. So I think there was a lot of torment about that.
Yes, yes. Mm. And your mother was under a lot of pressure, as was normal, to denounce her husband, you know, to dissociate her, that he had become bad. If she wanted to have an easy life, she should denounce him and divorce him and have nothing to do with him. But she refused to do that. And can you describe something of what was done to her as a result of this standing by her husband?
Yes. Yes, my father and my mother refused to denounce my father. So as a result, she was put through over 100 of these ghastly denunciation meetings. And basically, the victims were forced to stand on the platform facing a hysterical crowd. And their arms were ferociously twisted to the back, and their heads were ferociously pushed down, and they were kicked and beaten. A huge plaque would be hung from their neck. And on my mother's neck, it said, "The stinking wife of Chang Shouyu," which is my father. So my mother was made to kneel on broken glass, and she was paraded in the streets where children spat at her and threw stones at her. She was exiled to a camp. But she survived.
Yes, yes. Throughout the Cultural Revolution, which lasted effectively until Mao's death, you and your mother had to control or hide your emotions the whole time. When Mao died, you were euphorically happy, but you knew this was dangerous, so you hid your face in the back of somebody near you, in order that people couldn't see that you were actually perfectly happy about it, because everybody had to be or pretend to be distraught and miserable at the death of Mao. So you were having to control your emotions for all these years, from the age of 11 or younger maybe, right the way up till 1976. So for well over 10 years. What was it like to continually be controlling what you say, and what effect did it have on what you were able to think? Were you able to think freely, or how did it affect you? And does it have a lasting effect on you?
Of course, everybody is different. I think for a lot of people, you are so used to acting, and you mix up whether you were acting or whether you were thinking, really, truly, truthfully. And I think for myself, for many years, even though I was brought up in this intense personality cult of Mao, Mao was like our God. And when we say what I say is absolutely true, we would say, "I swear to Chairman Mao." And so it was that sort of upbringing. But then when I saw all these atrocities and violence again in the Cultural Revolution, I started to hate this society I was living in. And I remember the moment when I really started to think these blasphemous thoughts, and it was on my birthday when I was 16, and I had written my first decent poem. I was in bed polishing my poem when I heard the door banging, and Red Guards had come to raid our flat. And if they saw my poem, I would be in trouble, my family would be in trouble. So I had quickly rushed to the bathroom to tear up my poem and flush it down the toilet. And afterwards, I was lying in bed thinking, we were told socialist China was paradise on earth. And if this is a paradise, what then is a hell? And then for many years, I blamed Madame Mao. I blamed the people around Mao. I still never could blame Mao. I couldn't spell out his name, and that was the power of brainwashing and terror. And so I was in this state until 1976. I also remember that moment. This is the 8 years after I had really thought, I hated that society. A friend, God gave me a copy of, I think it was Newsweek, and in it there was by then I had been studying English, And then there was an article with a little picture of Mao and little picture of Madam Mao. And the caption says, Madam Mao is Mao's eyes, ears, and mouth. And that single line, and suddenly through open this window in my eye, in my mind, and I suddenly realized, of course, Mao was responsible. He was responsible for all these terrors of the Cultural Revolution. How could I not have thought of this before? And you see, I think it's just, I mean, not to underestimate the power of brainwashing.
Yes, yes. There were many in the communist revolution and the years in the 20s and 30s and beyond, in right up into the 60s, there were many very talented and determined and brave communist leaders. But Mao was the one who became the all-powerful one. What was it about Mao that made him come out on top?
Mao come up on top.
On top of all the others who were, they were very able people, but he cast them aside or destroyed them.
The Chinese.
A fellow communists.
I think terrorization is the most important aspect. Brainwashing, I think I would say.
And I mean, one of the people he got rid of was Liu Shaoqi.
Yes.
How did he? I mean, he was the number two in China, a very, very senior person. And yet, through the Cultural Revolution, Mao was able to get rid of him. Can you describe at all how he managed to get rid of him? A major rival.
Well, the thing is, it's a long story. Yeah.
But essentially, he used the Red Guards, did he not, to attack him in the first place?
Mao used the Red Guard to attack him. Yes, I mean, I think the personality cult of Mao played a big role, and.
I was asking how did Mao get rid of Liu Shaoqi, and the Red Guards attacked him and his house, and he must have realized at that point that Mao was trying to destroy him, because Mao had given the okay to the Red Guards, and then he was arrested, and he was very strong man, but he was helpless, and I guess you could say that it's the technique was to have such a cult of personality where you obey Chairman Mao that he got lots of people to obey him, and he could use them to destroy other leaders.
Yes, you're right. Well, that is it. I mean, by the time Liu was destroyed or Mao turned down Liu. Mao had already got absolute power. He was able to. Liu was nothing, you know, when I grew up. Even though he was the president of China, he had no profile among the population. And so it's all Mao, this personality cult.
And he also had become his number one hated person because he had opposed and criticized what Mao had done. And so Mao wanted to get him, and he did.
Yes.
And there were a string of others.
Well, the dictator on the scale of Mao and Stalin, and of course Lenin, and now we see Putin is in some way. Once you become a dictator, it's very hard to get rid of you. I mean, then what you say, you know, like Kim, I mean, he's killed quite a few people around him, and Mao killed, you know, people.
They have to be willing to kill people who they grew up with, who they were colleagues, who were fellow fighters, and then turn on them and destroy them.
Yes, well, exactly. I mean, the biography of Mao, which I wrote with my husband, we interviewed the old communists, and I remember saying, the communist who was the last survivor of this, we interviewed my husband and I, during our research about the biography of Mao, we interviewed communists. So I commented that Zhou Enlai, who was the prime minister, was very hard, merciless. And this old communist said with a smile, with the gentlest smile, and said, for our communists, to be hard and merciless is a virtue. I think that was the communist doctrine.
Yes.
It's that right, the ideology made people hard and merciless, and regard that as a virtue.
Yes. Now, one other thing, you describe at one point how you were. It could be regarded as almost like a crime to look in a mirror in public. Tell me about the restrictions on clothes and what you wore and makeup and showiness and colours. How was that treated in the Cultural Revolution?
Oh, there was no makeup. There was no makeup, not just in the Cultural Revolution, before the Cultural Revolution. I was growing up without makeup. Without anywhere with makeup. I remember very well my grandmother just touching her eyebrows slightly and dabbing a little red on her lips, not with even the makeup, but some flowers she made. I mean, that was so unusual. That was completely unusual. That's why I remembered as a child seeing my grandmother making these flowers, making this thing from a kind of flower which is very red. It's not an English flower. I mean, you soak these flowers in the water, and somehow you make your own
natural makeup.
Natural makeup. So my grandmother was using a little, and all this was completely unusual.
And could you wear clothes that you are wearing today with a bright yellow scarf? Could you do that?
No, there isn't.
What would happen to you if you did?
No. Well, first of all, the most important thing is these things were not available. I mean, the state, it is a kind of a totalitarian, it is a totalitarian state. So people wore a kind of uniforms. I mean, these uniforms, it's the easiest thing for a totalitarian regime to produce if the whole country wear the same thing. I mean, imagine, basically Mao's policy was to save every penny for his military industries because he wanted to dominate the world. That was his dream, unfulfilled dream, which was why he died such a sad man. So he was cutting down on everything for the population to the minimum. So we have nothing, and we were all wearing, in the Cultural Revolution particularly, we were wearing a sort of Mao suit.
So you're wearing a kind of khaki green or brown?
No, it's not a khaki green, it's blue.
Blue.
Blue, ill-fitting, baggy trousers, because it's, like one size, several sizes. Different sizes fit all.
And you would get into trouble if you somehow did get some clothes from the past or colour?
Yes, well, they were clothes to the past, and before the Cultural Revolution, people were wearing some of those. But which is why, at the beginning of the Cultural Revolution, one thing the Red Guards did was to stand on street corners and cut people's skirt.
Really?
Yes, they cut people's skirt and they cut the long high heels. I mean, not really high, but semi-high, like not completely flat. So the Red Guards would cut people's heels. Which, after that, obviously nobody dared to wear anything that, that, is, that had the slightest color.
And the theory behind that was that you should not be vain. Is that right?
Well,
you should be give up individualism, like it's in autumn individualism goes.
Definitely, yes. But there is a more practical reason, which is the regime didn't want people to want to have materialism, and not because they really wanted them to be also pure, but because they wanted to save every penny for Mao's military industries.
Yes. But I mean, the as you mentioned earlier, the pulling up of grass. And when you came to England, you were very impressed by the flowers everywhere. And you went to Kew Gardens because it was so full of plants and flowers. And that for you was a big contrast with the China you had left. Can you describe where were the flowers in China, which is famous for having produced many of the flowers we grow today?
Yes. Well, I mean, even just before the Cultural Revolution, when Mao was preparing it in 1964-65, and Mao had condemned horticulture, and he said all these cultivating flowers and grass are keeping birds, or some people, and pets. There were bourgeois habits and must be get rid of all the gardeners. I mean, in fact, the gardener of my school, middle school, died, either beaten to death or driven to suicide. And so we all had to go out to remove the grass from the school lawn. I remember
to remove grass. I mean, it sounds an extraordinary, bizarre,
unbelievable.
Did it not seem to you that the Cultural Revolution was a kind of madness?
It was that it wasn't the Cultural Revolution yet. Just before when I was 13. I mean, I was intensely sad about doing this, but I remember I immediately had to suppress my sadness and blame myself for having the thought that was not in line with Mao's instructions. So that's how, also from your earlier question, that's how you always have to constantly suppress any thoughts that was not in line with what Mao said.
In a way, it seems that Mao was trying to change human nature, because it is natural, surely, to appreciate beauty, to like pretty things. And he was saying, you know, almost like a relation similar to Puritanism, where, you know, you must not enjoy these things, but it's a useless attempt because you cannot change human nature.
I think for Mao, it was something more sinister. He wanted to deculturalize and dehumanize the Chinese population, so he could use them like draft animals, simply to work, to do the work he wanted them to do, and to have no human feelings. And I think this is the thing. I mean, there is always, I later realized after I wrote Wild Swans, when I was researching my biography of Mao, there is always a very sinister practical side to seemingly ideological orders. For example, the raiding people's houses, it created a terror. It also emptied possessions, any artistic possessions from people's homes. And these possessions, the more valuable ones, were put in a state warehouse, to which Mao and a small number of the top leaders had access. And Mao got most of his books from these house raids. I mean, have you seen this picture of Mao talking to Nixon or Kissinger with these bookshelves behind him, vast numbers of books, and Kissinger commented that Mao's sitting room was more like a scholar's study. But what he didn't say, didn't know, was they were like Goering's galleries. I mean, all these books were from these housewives. I mean, forcefully taken from people's households. At these house raids, I mean, the owners were usually beaten up. I mean, so what? Just you may be interested in this, but this, I mean, so people, of course, were frightened. I mean, the book owners, and so they sold some, or had to burn their own books, and the books were burned across China, and some sold their books to scrap paper shops because they didn't want the Red Guards to come and see these books and beat them up. And I had a 13-year-old brother who loved collecting stamps, but collecting stamps was also condemned as a bourgeois habit. And so his interests, no, let me tell this story from the beginning. So these frightened book owners sold their books to scrap paper stations. And my brother, my 13-year-old brother, saw this and bought a lot of books from the scrap paper selections. So he built up a collection of foreign and Chinese classics of about 1,000 copies, wow, which was huge, which he hid in the waste paper towel. But of course, not all at the same time, because there was a black market dealing in books. So he was trading these books and got new ones and bought new ones. And this was because he was very entrepreneurial and he loved collecting things. He used to collect stamps as a child, but because Mao had condemned collecting even stamps, so people's instinct in collecting turned to a sanctioned item, which was the badge of Mao. And at the time, in all of China's factories stopped normal production to produce hundreds of millions, or more than 1 billion, billions of Mao badges. And these badges have different colors and different materials, different sizes. And so my brother became a connoisseur in the Mao badge, and he dealt with them on the market.
I did. Ironic to have a capitalist trading of a Mao badge.
It is. I mean, of course, they were constantly raided by police, and people were, when you were caught and you were punished, usually by being stabbed on your bottom. Yeah. And there was a standard punishment for these traders on the black market. But my brother made a small fortune dealing in the Mao badge, and he bought these books from on another black market, trading the books.
So, looking at the big picture again, do you think that the Cultural Revolution, which was ostensibly to refresh and reinvigorate communism in China, was in fact a means for Mao to regain the power he had previously had?
Yes, and to regain the power he was losing because of the Great Famine,
which had been such a disaster.
It was such a disaster. I think it's almost an understatement, because 40 million people died of starvation, and all because Mao wanted to build a first-class military superpower, so he could dominate the world. And he was exporting food to Russia and to Eastern Europe in exchange for these expensive military industries. So even his colleagues, even President Liu Shaoqi, who must be a hard man, was a hard man since he could rise to be Mao's number two, they couldn't take this. And so at a party congress, President Liu ambushed Mao. This was January 1962, and forced Mao to abandon his policy, which was the Great Leap.
What is your opinion of Mao, the person?
I mean, I can't find one word to describe him. Monster. I mean, so many people for much, much less things were described as a monster. Tyrant, again, so many people were described as a tyrant. I failed to find words to describe him in one adjective.
He basically would be willing to dispose of anybody's life if it would give him advantage. He would torture people, he would kill people, he would do actions which resulted in the deaths of millions, as in the Great Famine. It was an extraordinary level of ruthlessness and selfishness, was it not?
I think it's maybe instead of describing Mao with one word or one sentence, if I could describe him with one thing he said. You know, the Great Famine, in which 40 million people died of starvation. And Mao knew these people would die. And Mao said, for all his projects to take off, half of China may have to die. And that was the dimension, extent of his evil.
Yes, it's stunning. Thank you very much, Yung Chang.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Museum of Communist Terror. You can follow our podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Podbean, and SoundCloud. Please also see our videos, briefs, and more on our website, www.museumofcommunistterror.com. If you subscribe to the website, you will receive occasional updates on our activities, events, and publications.